And she was like, no, that's
yeah,
a straw.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not laying importance on the things that you buy and then when it's lost, right?
Yeah, so.
Yeah, no, that even is israf in effect, that you have to buy again.
Yeah,
in the long run, you need
exactly.
it, right? So it's like if, for example, you iron roughly your clothes and they get burnt, it's just a worldly thing. No, that doesn't mean that. You know, you take care of it. Or you wear your shoes. In fact, our Ahlul Bayt used to have the clothes, special attire for outside and for the home wear.
Yeah.
So outside, you know, your clothes are preserved so that you don't keep on buying other clothes, and homeware is like you know, they get worn out and everything. So it doesn't mean that, you know, you keep on, you know, like you're underestimating the fact that this dunya is nothing and
yeah.
okay,
everything,
yeah, everything,
you know, it's
good.
Okay,
yeah, it's okay. No, that's wasting actually.
Yeah.
So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also says, "Kulu washrabu wa la tusrifu," so eat and drink, but do not do israf. And sometimes israf can be done in also overeating, for example, as far as eating is concerned,
yeah.
you know, overdoing something. So israf is not just that you, for example, not do it, or it
yeah.
can be done.
Sometimes
excessive doing it. And
yeah,
or
definitely.
Not doing it at all is also israf. For example, sometimes we have some food that is left over and we feel that if we don't eat it, it will be israf. No, our stomachs will pain in the end. So that is more israf. So we have to decipher.
Yeah, very true. So we're just going to take a quick break and pick up shortly from this.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing a very important aspect to inculcate in our children, which is how to handle money. And you've been mentioning about, you know, you don't have to waste it or uselessly spend it. And, you know, money is actually something that we have to be careful about, and just generally to instill that in our children.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Do you have anything more
yeah.
to say
the
about
last that? But not least is one a master character trait and virtue, that by observing all these things that I talked about in the previous programs and even today, some of them, is that piety will be achieved.
Mm.
That piety that we are working for, without spelling it to be a taqwa, a piety, telling them, be pious. All these qualities will instill a piety in him, a fear of him, that what he's doing, he should be aware, he should be truthful, he should be trustworthy, he should not, you know, like me, he should be grateful to his parents, that Allah has given him such good parents, or parents at least.
Yeah.
He should be grateful for that, and he should be also not wasting his time, money, energy, be focused, be determined. All these things, if you go and see, gives a perfect plan for a teenager to tread on that path, that of perfection that Allah wants for him, and that his growth lies in it, and he will become successful in both worlds. So without telling, you know, come, I teach you about piety. You know what piety is?
Yeah.
No. Teach about all these things, truthfulness, trust, worldliness, you know, like respecting parents, respecting elders. All these things come under being grateful, of course, to parents, because parents would like their children to respect elders also.
Definitely.
Being determined, having a goal, a purpose, not wasting time, money, you know,
all this together
bring about the taqwa. So we as elders also, if we want the taqwa, we should practice all this, and more so teenagers, because teenagers have that aptitude of picking up very fast, being influenced.
Yeah.
You know, so if we, you know, just they will think about it. They won't, you know, you can fool a child easily, but you can't fool a teenager or an adult. They will see your actions, that if they're doing that and their contrary is speaking something else. So we should be very careful, especially in your teenagers. If you want to start right away, we can do that without, you know, beforehand. Like this parent, mashallah, she's very determined to do a great job on her teenager. I pray for that to happen.
Inshallah.
So she's been like wanting to know beforehand.
Yeah, and I think when you see such a teenager, you know, who has all these qualities, kind of have a certain sort of
love and attraction
for
them. Right?
Yeah, because it's something very hard to come by, and it's something very hard. They have to have a lot of, you know, willpower to be able to do all of this. So it's definitely,
and our scholars were like that. Imagine those tender teenagers were like that. Like great scholar of Ayatollah Miss Bayazdi. He was just 17 when he came, and how he was as a teenager, you know, you feel, mashallah, what upbringing he must have had, that he had all those quality.
Right.
And that's why when he passed away, like, he was so, mashallah, with so many good, you know, like, he left behind so many good teachings and books and
definitely
all his works.
And I think just recently we were talking to some of the, we were seeing actually a video, and they were saying, you know, why do we have all these shuhada martyrs, streets names, and like, why is it so important to constantly remind yourself that, okay, this is the, they know that they live in the street, and they don't know much about that shaheed, but just this reminder that you have these kind of youth who are able to kind of be such pure people,
accomplish such things,
and it was hard, but they managed, so we can
exactly, and they were not masoom, so if they were not, and they could, so why not us?
Definitely,
any teenager, if he sees and is given this kind of atmosphere, will reach great heights.
Definitely,
I believe that strongly,
inshallah. So we're just going to take another short break, and we'll be back soon.
Ya muqiy al khayrat, ya muqiy al khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Ya muqiy al khayrat, ya muqiy al khayrat.
Welcome back, and we're going to pose another question where somebody has asked, "My 15-year-old daughter doesn't talk about any of her problems with me, and I can know she's going through some tough times, but she feels I'm nagging when I ask her how she's facing all these problems. How do I make her confide in me?"
When teenagers, you know, come of that age, they suddenly become aloof.
Yeah.
You know, because they want their independence. It's not a wrong thing. We should allow that also. But this parent seems like she must be nagging, if that girl feels like she's nagging.
Okay.
Her daughter feels like she's nagging. Because children know when the parents are not nagging or they are nagging, right? When you keep on asking, keep on stressing, then the child will not feel like. In fact, they'll be more stubborn not to say that, yeah?
Mm.
So what the teenagers, especially girls, they're soft-hearted, they need support, love, empathy. All these things are very important. So if the parent gives that quiet moment and then steals, you know, quickly steals the moment when the child is talking, you know, finds a good moment and becomes an active listener. This is very important. Active listening. Active listening is when you're, for example, doing even something and the child wants to talk a little to you, immediately go to the child and listen to them, especially when it comes to teenagers, and especially when it comes to this girl who's 15-year-old and doesn't want to talk about anything. At some point in time, the parents will try to make them happier, maybe cook their best meal or make them laugh, or, you know, become lighthearted. Even the mood of the home, you know, the atmosphere should be so lighthearted so that it penetrates in the mind and heart, and not anxiety filled that you're worried, she's worried, okay, there's a kind of ice in between. Calm behavior, okay, this happens, this is normal. Then slowly, slowly they let out. As soon as they start talking, grasp the moment. Whatever you're doing, if they need you, grasp the moment. Not that, okay, now I'm doing, hold on, let me finish this ironing of mine or cooking of mine, then I'm coming to sit with you. No. Leave that aside, however urgent it might be, which is not that much urgent, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Any home task cannot be that urgent. It can wait a little. And go and talk and confide so that the girl can confide. And when she sees that there's a reassurance, there's a love, there's a empathy, obviously she will even talk about it.
Yeah.
Whatever be it, even it'll be little, she won't let out. Don't expect that they let out each and every detail of what they're going through. But they will at least say what's going on. Maybe she lost her friend. Maybe she fought with her friend, or maybe she was scolded by her teacher, or given warnings, or harmed by somebody, or hit by somebody. She will talk about it then. Yeah? What's bothering her? Teenagers, they have this kind of problems.
And I feel like many times the teenagers feel that, you know, the parents don't take their problem seriously, you know, like, for example, this is important to me, but if my mother just takes it lightly, or, you know, then I feel like she doesn't understand me, you know,
exactly.
Like, she doesn't get me.
But so, my friend understands
but
me.
Yeah, for example, others understand me. So this kind of relationship, I feel like I had a very nice relationship with my mom. She would, you know, try and understand me. She would try and be an active listener. And I felt like that is the main reason why I never fell astray, because she was constantly like there, was backing me up, you know, was giving me that support, which I felt like I was...
There's somebody to understand me and love
me. She understands me.
And don't complain.
Definitely.
Right?
So I think that is very important. So we're going to end here, and inshallah, maybe we can expand on this in the next episode. Thank you so much for your valuable time, and we hope to see you in the next episode. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening. And this was IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. If you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI, which is Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can also email us on englishradio@irib.ir. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Less than 2 weeks after launching its genocide on the Gaza Strip, the Israeli military committed one of the most heinous atrocities in modern history. Back on October 18th, a huge blast rocked the Al-Ahli hospital compound in Gaza, which was packed with thousands of Palestinians seeking shelter from the Israeli strikes. According to Palestinian health officials, more than 470 people were killed in that incident. Most of the victims were defenseless civilians who had taken shelter at the hospital and its surrounding areas. At the time, they had no idea that the Israeli regime might target hospitals. Hospitals and clinics have special protections under international law, and the deliberate targeting of these facilities is a clear violation of these principles. As usual, the Israeli army first denied that it was behind the attack. Later, the regime and its Western allies, including the United States and Canada, claimed that the explosion was caused by an errant rocket fired by the armed group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. However, independent investigations by various media sources have debunked this propaganda. The New York Times conducted a thorough analysis of video footage from the night of October 17th, which clearly showed that the missile seen in the video, supposedly fired by Palestinian fighters, did not cause the explosion at the hospital. Instead, it detonated in the sky, approximately 2 miles away. It was, in fact, a missile fired by the Israeli military that caused a devastating explosion.
According to all feeds and videos analyzed, this rocket was intercepted and was the last one launched from Gaza before the bombing of the hospital. 5 seconds after that interception, an explosion in Gaza can be seen, followed 2 seconds later by a much larger explosion. This is the strike that hit Al-Ahli Arab Hospital.
As a result,
Al Jazeera Digital Investigations Team found no grounds to the Israeli army claim that the strike on the Al Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza was caused by a failed rocket launch.
But Al Ahli Hospital was not the last hospital targeted by the Israeli military during its onslaught in Gaza. According to a report by Human Rights Watch in 2023, the Israeli military has repeatedly and unlawfully attacked medical facilities, personnel, and transport, further destroying Gaza's healthcare system. The report says that these attacks should be investigated as war crime, as they violated international humanitarian law.
Because every society has the right to have a healthcare system, and that's why the healthcare system is protected by the Geneva Convention. And the fourth Geneva Convention is utterly clear, has always been. And that's why these attacks on healthcare that are so well documented, and the most extreme, the most brutal examples are the situations like we have in Nasser Medical Complex now, where they're shooting and killing staff and patients inside. And the situation we had in the West Bank, where they again dressed up like doctors, fake doctors, and relatives coming and hid their weapons and went into this room and shot and killed this patient who was actually immobilized, this Palestinian young man, and his two companions. Killed him, executed him and his two companions under the disguise of being medical personnel. The reason why this is so serious and why it is not stopped is so serious is that it threatens the immunity of the healthcare system and the safe network, the safety network that the healthcare system provides to people around the world.
On January 31st, an undercover Israeli death squad posing as Palestinians brazenly infiltrated a hospital in the occupied West Bank, resulting in the assassination of three Palestinians, one of whom was a partially paralyzed patient. Surveillance footage captured the alarming scene as approximately a dozen Israeli special forces raided Ibn Sina Hospital in the northern city of Jenin. Disguised as Palestinian medical personnel and civilian women, they brandished rifles while navigating through the corridors, perpetrating this shocking act in broad daylight. According to the World Health Organization, Israel has conducted nearly 400 attacks on healthcare facilities in the Gaza Strip, including on every single one of its hospitals, leaving the majority non-functional as of February 12th. This illustration, published by the WHO, details the Israeli strikes on healthcare facilities in the Gaza Strip. According to the report by the World Health Organization, at least 659 people have lost their lives and more than 840 others injured in Israeli attacks as of February 12th. Nearly 100 ambulances have been targeted, with more than 50 destroyed by the Israeli missiles. As of February 12th, only 11 out of 36 hospitals in Gaza are partially functioning, 5 in the north and 6 in the south. According to the World Health Organization, hospital bed capacity across all of Gaza has now been reduced from 3,500 to just 1,400. But this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the disaster seems to be much worse. Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, is one of the international organizations actively working in Gaza despite Israeli attacks. Doctors Without Borders has already lost several staff members in recent months as a result of Israeli attacks. In the most recent attack, the Israeli military deliberately targeted an MSF shelter in Gaza, killing two people and wounding several others. As an international charity organization, MSF is committed to independence, neutrality, and impartiality, as it only seeks to provide medical services to vulnerable people across the world, especially those trapped in conflicts and war zones. According to MSF, the Israeli military systematically targets health facilities in Gaza. Médecins Sans Frontières deplores a situation in which people have been left with no options to go for treatment in case of a large influx of war-wounded patients. These systematic attacks against healthcare are unacceptable and must end now so that the wounded can get the care they need. The entire health system has been rendered inoperative. As a matter of fact, the targeting of hospitals in Gaza by the Israeli military has tragically become an everyday occurrence. Just recently, a harrowing voice message was sent by a Palestinian capturing the horrifying sounds of Israeli bombing echoing from Nasser Hospital in Rafah.
About what's happening here in Nasser Hospital. There was direct bombing to the hospital. They forced people inside the hospital, including patients, relatives. Oh, Ya Allah. Patients, relatives, and healthcare workers to evacuate immediately. And you can hear in the background the continuous bombing in the hospital.
This blatant act of aggression saw Israeli soldiers storming the hospital in broad daylight, a clear violation of international laws governing the protection of medical facilities and personnel during armed conflict.
Israeli soldiers and tanks continue to shoot and bomb in the nearby area, inside and outside the hospital. The tanks moving inside the hospital. We cannot look through the window.
The extent of attacks by the Israeli military leaves no doubt that the regime is deliberately and systematically targeting the medical centers in Gaza. Israel is now directly targeting medical staff in Gaza. But why is Israel destroying hospitals and deliberately targeting doctors and medical staff in Gaza?
Is that not only is Israel systematically targeting medical facilities, but they are targeting medical professionals. And Israel's objective in targeting medical professionals is to cripple the health sector by killing an entire generation of doctors, to the extent that building the hospitals after the genocide would not even suffice to restore the health sector. I mean, it's such an unspeakable thing, but this is all part of Israel's goal to make Gaza completely uninhabitable and compelling Palestinians to leave the Gaza Strip, which is one of Israel's ultimate war goals.
Such brazen attacks come amid the unequivocal support from Israel's staunch allies, including the United States and its European supporters, who have not only remained silent, but also supplied Israel with deadly weapons and ammunition to continue its genocide in Gaza.
My point is that it's horrible. And the most horrible thing about what is going on in Nasser Hospital now is that this has been going on for 4 months without no power stopping it. So, I don't know. I think the Israelis, with their impunity, they just keep going because no military force or political force or international alliance of decent nations are able to stop them. The only one who can stop them is the United States, and they don't want to stop them. They continue to supply them with political support and weapons. So this madness is a result of a deliberate politics, a deliberate policy from the United States, and unfortunately also from many of the European governments.
The United Nations has repeatedly condemned Israel's attacks on civilian targets, including hospitals in Gaza. In 2023, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution that condemned Israel's attacks on hospitals and called for an independent investigation into the attacks. However, the resolution has not been implemented, as Israel enjoys impunity thanks to the unwavering support from its staunch ally, the United States, and other Western countries. The recent U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza has once again underscored the hypocrisy of those who claim to champion human rights and has highlighted the inefficacy of international organizations in addressing Israel's occupation regime. It has become evident that only through alliances among independent nations can we hope to halt such atrocities.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. July 12, 1983. Place Hosseinia Jamaran, Tehran. Subject: Spiritual Purification and Focus on Spirituality. The contents of the mandatory prayer are also expression of glorification of Allah and takbir, and are eulogizing and praise. This is because that perhaps it wants us to understand. It wants all of the human being to understand that in the very first one, that you want to enter the greatest worship of Allah, you be aware that the blessed and almighty Allah is greater than that, you worship Him.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. This is the Spring of the Truth, and I am Bita, the host of today's episode. We're going to start with this sentence from Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its revolution. Today's sentence is: struggle for purification of ethics and encourage your friends to moral edification. As you know, the Amr bil Ma'ruf, Nahy anil Munkar, or persuading other people in order to do good deeds and forbidding them from doing bad deeds, is one of the principles of our religion, Islam. And it is the most common activity in all social settings, for sure. Sometimes it may be explicit, we argue for or against something, and at others, it's implicit. We show interest or lack of interest. More often than we realize, we're engaged in persuading others or are being persuaded by them about big and small things in life. It's a very powerful force also. That is why that marketers yearn for word-of-mouth publicity, and powerful media machines long for becoming the talk of the town. So, concerned with good as it is, Islam gives this tremendous social force a purpose. It must be used for promoting good, truth, and justice, and checking evil and injustice. That is the essence of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar.
صلى الله عليه صل يا رسول الله
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله.
The Quran declares it as the defining mission for this ummah. You are the best community that has been raised for mankind. You enjoin good and forbid evil, and you believe in Allah. At another place, Quran declares promoting good as an attribute of believers and promoting evil as an attribute of hypocrites. The believers, men and women, are protectors of each other. They enjoin what is right and forbid what is evil. On the other hand, the hypocrites, both men and women, proceed one from another. They enjoin the wrong and forbid the right. So, as we see, even in the Holy Quran, we have this tinge of Amr bin Ma'ruf, Nahy anil Munkar, our religion and principles of our religion, which we saw in the speech of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, defender of Islamic Republic of Iran and the revolution, which wasn't only the revolution of Ummah, it was a revolution of hearts and souls. May Allah bless all of us and put us in a revolutionary form to the path of His satisfaction.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illa Allah.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means to...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Please stay with us. Today's tip, it's time to welcome the holy month of Ramadan and how it's going to increase our ubudiyah. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. So, dear listeners, we are talking about how we should welcome the holy month of Ramadan and how it will increase our ubudiyah. Now, we are on the cusp and the brink of the holy month of Ramadan. The holy month of Ramadan, of course, is this beautiful banquet. It is this invitation. It is this great feast, full of divine spiritual blessings and benefits for every single one of us. Now, it is important for us, before we get into the holy month of Ramadan, whether it is a day before or 2 days before or a few days before, to really sit down and kind of contemplate and think about what kind of a month we are entering. Now, the holy month of Ramadan, of course, is this month of ubudiyah. It is this month of the worship and the servitude and the obedience to Allah. It is perhaps one of the most beautiful manifestations of ubudiyah. When we look at even different religions, we find that this aspect of worship and servitude and obedience to Allah in the form of fasting is present. And we see that many of the religions of the world, they do fasting in order to be able to gain spirituality and to be able to get rid of their many various materialistic chains that are upon them. And so we have to sit and think and reflect and give a little bit of time in order to understand that this holy month of Ramadan that is coming up is something that is quite serious. It is something that is an opportunity. It is something that, yes, it involves trials and hardships, and it involves a little bit of difficulty. But the rewards that come out of the holy month of Ramadan are million times fold. And it can be very comfortably said that the ultimate reward is unimaginable. In the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt and the Immaculates, alayhim as-salam, we find that they very eloquently and profoundly say that Allah says that everything has a reward, and the reward for fasting is me, Allah, myself.
Ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Manan,
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
This question comes up, especially when we talk to those who have never heard about Islam, don't know much about Muslims. And when you say that we have to fast for 30 days in the month of Ramadan, from dawn to dusk, not even allowed to drink water, for them it's a very difficult issue to digest. And they say, you know, why do you go through hunger and thirst for 30 days? Why do you go through this struggle and hardship or suffering? The reasons can be given of different kinds. You know, if you just look at the benefits which have been described from different dimensions. Just recently, this month of June, on the 5th of June, there was a report from the scientists of the University of South California. But after their observation and research, there was a very interesting statement where they said, fasting for as little as 3 days can generate the entire immune system, even among the elderly ones. Now remember, 3 days minimum fasting. It's interesting that when we look at many of the sunnat fasts that we have, besides the month of Ramadan, you know, 13th, 14th, 15th, or Laylatul Raghaib is again 3 days. Many other nazar that people do is 3 days. And it's interesting that, you know, the scientists there, they say this regenerates the immune system, even among elderly. They further said that the discovery could be particularly beneficial for people suffering from damaged immune system, such as cancer patients who are on chemotherapy. And so yes, there is a medical benefit to fasting, no doubt about it. On social level, you know, this is an opportunity of helping those who are less fortunate in the society. The issue of fitrah is actually a sign of that. Because when we are hungry and thirsty, we can relate more to the poor and the needy in the community. According to our ahadith, one of the benefits of fasting is that the gap between the rich and poor is reduced. Not totally, but it is brought closer.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
Mark Mattson is chief of the Laboratory of Neuroscience at the National Institute on Aging. He is also a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University and a researcher in the area of cellular and molecular mechanisms underlying multiple neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. With his team, he has published several papers that discuss how fasting twice a week could significantly lower the risk of developing both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. He says, dietary changes have long been known to have an effect on the brain. Children who suffer from epileptic seizures have fewer of them when placed on caloric restriction or fasts. It is believed that fasting helps kickstart protective measures that help counteract the overexcited signals that epileptic brains often exhibit. Normal brains, when overfed, can experience another kind of uncontrolled excitation, impairing the brain's function. Matson and another researcher reported in the journal Nature Reviews Neuroscience. Fasting is amazing for the brain, and this is evident by all of the beneficial neurochemical changes that happen in the brain when we fast. It improves cognitive function, increases neurotrophic factors, increases stress resistance, and reduces inflammation. Fasting is a challenge to your brain, and your brain responds by adapting stress response pathways which help your brain cope with stress and risk for disease. The same changes that occur in the brain during fasting mimic the changes that occur with exercise, as they both increase the production of protein in the brain, neurotrophic factors, which in turn promotes the growth of neurons and the connection between neurons. He says, "Challenges to your brain, whether it's intermittent fasting or vigorous exercise, are cognitive challenges. When this happens, neurocircuits are activated. Levels of neurotrophic factors increase that promotes the growth of neurons and the formation and strengthening of synapses. Fasting also stimulates the production of new nerve cells from stem cells in the hippocampus. Matson also mentions ketones, an energy source for neurons, and how fasting stimulates the production of ketones, and that it may also increase the number of mitochondria in neurons. Fasting also increases the number of mitochondria in nerve cells. This comes as a result of the neurons adapting to the stress of fasting by producing more mitochondria. By increasing the number of mitochondria in the neurons, the ability for neurons to form and maintain the connections between each other also increases, thereby improving memory and learning ability. Intermittent fasting enhances the ability of nerve cells to repair DNA. He explains how our ancestors adapted and were built for going long periods of time without food.
شربنا على فكري
حبيبي مدامة
ساكرنا بها من قبل
لأن يخلق الكرم.
IRIB English Radio.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So in continuation to what we were saying, of course, which was this idea that we should welcome the holy month of Ramadan, we should understand and contemplate a little bit about the month in which we are about to enter. And of course, we said that there are some difficulties and trials and hardships when it comes to the holy month of Ramadan. Nobody can deny that. But the rewards are really a million times fold. We talked about the ultimate reward, which is, of course, Allah Himself. Now, what does that mean? I don't really know, because it is such a profound statement. But what I do know is that the reward is therefore not capable of being calculated in any shape, way, or form. So anyways, we're talking about welcoming the holy month of Ramadan. Of course, this is a month which is very intimately connected with ubudiyah, with the worship and the servitude and the obedience to Allah. It is a month in which we are pretty much spending all of our time in the ubudiyah of the Almighty Allah. Now, just as a very quick side note, because since we haven't entered into the month of Ramadan, it is good to have certain things handy, you know, so that we don't make those mistakes in this holy month that is coming up. One is to stay away from things that are prohibited and are haram to our utmost level best. This is one thing that we should be very, very careful about in this holy month of Ramadan. The second thing is to, at the least, try to do all of our wajibat, to try to do all of the things that are wajib upon us in this holy month, whether it is our daily prayers or it is the fasting. Off the top of my head, I believe these are the only two wajib things. There could be more, but off the top of my head, those are two that came up. These have to be done. Sometimes we make the mistake of doing the mustahabbat, the things which are recommended, but we forget to do the wajib things. Another thing is to not overeat, and I think we're running out of time on the program, is don't overeat in this holy month of Ramadan. Remember, the point of fasting is to be able to detach ourselves from these materialistic aspects so that in the holy month of Ramadan, we are able to level up and strengthen our ubudiyyah, and that inshallah, this will continue after the holy month of Ramadan, where we have practiced and really strengthened our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم
To avert famine, there must be road access to Gaza's north. Words from the World Food Program. After apartheid Israel turns back a convoy trying to get food into Gaza. Hello everyone and welcome back to Gaza Under Attack. I'm Saeed Bourza. U.S.-Israeli bombs continue to rain down on Palestinians in Gaza as talks for a ceasefire grind on in Cairo, Egypt. Hamas has presented its proposal for a ceasefire agreement to mediators. The Israeli regime has not sent any negotiators to the talks. What will their response be? Lebanon's Hezbollah has launched heavy rocket barrages at an Israeli kibbutzim in the north of the 1948 occupied territories in response to an air raid that killed three civilians in southern Lebanon. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, have called for an immediate and durable humanitarian ceasefire in the besieged territory as the holy month of Ramadan approaches. And apartheid Israel's war cabinet minister Benny Gantz in London after spending 2 days meeting power brokers in Washington. Is this the beginning of the end for Benjamin Netanyahu? In only 5 months, the U.S. Europe-backed Israeli genocidal campaign in Gaza has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians and wounded over 72,000 others. With us on this edition of the program, British-Palestinian student and activist Tariq Othman, and Rick Sterling, a veteran journalist working with the L.A. Progressive, Anti-War, and Al Mayadeen, to name just a few. Rick joins us via Skype from the Bay Area in California, USA. Thank you both for being here. I'll start with you, Rick. Biden gave the impression a ceasefire was as good as done and dusted, yet here we are. What do you think are the stumbling blocks to a cessation of violence at the moment?
Well, the main stumbling block is the United States' refusal to demand that Israel stop its genocide. There have been three United Nations Security Council resolutions that the United States alone has vetoed. The latest manipulation and trick is for the U.S. to say that Hamas is responsible, but in truth, it's the U.S. and the Israeli government.
What do you make of the U.S. government's claim of putting pressure on Israel to agree to a truce, albeit temporary, and a captive swap?
Well, I think they definitely want a fig leaf, and Joe Biden and Joe Biden's team they realize they're in big trouble because the majority of the population in the U.S. and even more so in the Democratic Party are supporting a ceasefire. So they're out on a limb, but they're so beholden to Zionist forces in the United States that they have to do this dance where they pretend to be calling and pushing for a ceasefire and abhorring the slaughter going on there. But at the same time, they want to give Israel more time to try to achieve their goal, which is not achievable.
Exactly. And of course, they continue to veto UN Security Council resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire, not to mention the continuing flow of American weapons and money to Israel. Tarek, let me come to you for the next one. How does all of this make you feel, that, you know, more than 5 months on, 152 days on, more than 30,000 people killed, more than 72,000 people wounded, and yet not an immediate permanent ceasefire?
I don't know, you know, what words there are left to describe the situation in Gaza right now and the situation in Palestine. Every combination of condemnation and visual imagery and visual description has been used. Every poet has used every last, you know, description they can think of. And I'm not going to better describe that. We, as all Palestinians, as all, you know, people who are seeing it, you know, see a genocide unfold with their own eyes, on camera, on Instagram, on social media, whilst our political class are 100% backing it, we've completely been lost for words. There's nothing that can describe it better than
what kind of action will you take? Because we're in an election year, not just here in the UK, but in the States and more than 50 other countries. When you see this dithering on the part of the political class here, as you put it, be it the conservatives or Labour, someone as young as you and the likes of you out there, how will you get back at these people, in power who can stop a genocide but won't or haven't so far?
Well, very simply, I would refuse to vote for any of these supposed representative parties. Many people make the comment that if I was to not vote for Keir Starmer or Labour, that would make a conservative leadership more likely. The very simple fact is that if we're going to profess to be in a democracy, then I have every right to have a party that represents me. If we are in a professed democracy, why am I being forced, in practically, to vote for people who we all know don't represent me and have no intention of representing me and the vast majority of the British public, which, as I'm sure you understand, 67%, I believe.
66%.
Support an immediate ceasefire. And yet, like you were saying, there's a complete, undemocratic and extremist attitude towards this that has justified, as we speak, the genocide of my people. And I'm not going to, vote or put my support behind anyone that hasn't done everything in their power possible to stop that.
And the rise in the number of independent candidates and minor parties is probably going to put an end to that political duopoly in Westminster.
Well, I hope so.
That is the hope. Rick, we've passed 150 days, as I mentioned earlier, of this relentless bombardment. What is your assessment of where things stand?
Well, in 1967, the U.S. launched a surprise attack on its Arab neighbors, and in 6 days, they were able to decimate the air forces of those neighbors and win that war. In contrast, we've got 150 days or five full months of Israeli slaughter, massacre, and killing, and they are nowhere near achieving their goals. The Palestinian resistance has withstood this onslaught, this slaughter, and I think the Israeli government is desperate because they can see that their goal of winning a quick victory is not being achieved. They can see that the world is increasingly turning against them, even the West, so that the U.S. is you know, almost alone. They're not entirely alone. Germany and the U.K. and France are still supporting them, but less and less so. So the pressure is building, and Netanyahu is desperate, and in a way the U.S. is desperate to see this come to an end.
He sure is desperate. There's, of course, divisions inside the Israeli so-called war cabinet. We'll talk about that in a little later in the program. But meantime, the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt have been attempting to hammer out a ceasefire agreement, at least on the look of it, for a number of weeks with seemingly little progress, despite early optimism. Earlier this week, the Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry met his Dutch counterpart for talks where the fate of the negotiations was outlined.
The negotiations are sensitive. I can't say there is optimism or pessimism, but we haven't reached yet a point at which we can achieve a ceasefire. But it is important that everyone understands the importance of achieving this and to take responsibility for the decisions to be taken in this regard. There must be a clear political will that goes along with this. And some countries have abilities, like the United States of America. And there is a development there in the remarks that were said by the American Vice President last night when she spoke about the importance of an immediate ceasefire.
Rick, let me come to you for this one as well. The Israelis have not bothered to send any negotiators to these talks going on in Cairo. Does this tell you just how little regard they have for the whole process?
Well, it's an indicator, and it's going to be interesting to see what they report back to the International Court of Justice, because they're coming up on the deadline where they have to report. Meanwhile, their overlords in Washington are in deep trouble. Just as in British politics, we're seeing upheavals with George Galloway winning a landslide victory. 7 days ago, we had a Democratic Party primary race in Michigan, which is a very key state in the United States election process, and over 100,000. Registered Democrats voted uncommitted. So this is a sign. Ideologically, Biden is a Zionist. He's dependent on Zionist funds, and yet most of the party is not feeling that way and is increasingly wondering what the heck is going on. So it's the same thing as your guest from Britain was saying, where this, you know, increasingly a contradiction between democracy and what we're seeing in reality.
Do those electoral developments in the States perhaps explain the Biden administration's eagerness to claim victory in some kind of a temporary truce?
I think they would be very happy to have that happen. But it's a bit of a smokescreen because they're talking about, just like you say, a temporary truce. And whereas other people are saying that we need to have a ceasefire that stops it once and for all.
Correct. And Tariq, Egypt, one of the parties to these ongoing negotiations, could they do more? And could the Arab bloc overall do more to bring an end to this?
I think there's a lot they can do to alleviate the suffering that Gazans are going through at the moment. The borders are still not as open as they should be. There's still not enough aid getting through. And I don't want to say that's the fault of Egypt in so much as it's the fault of the Egyptian leadership, which is an important distinction to make. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree that Egyptian leadership, just as much of the Arab leadership, is not at all representative of the population of the people in these countries. But what we are definitely seeing is a very lackluster response. I think all of us Arab Palestinians are utterly disappointed in what has been, you know, little more than words and messages, and a couple